Today's special episode features Dr. Ariel Lefkowitz, an internal medicine physician and medical educator. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, Ariel was put in charge of all infected non-ICU patients at Sunnybrook Hospital in Toronto. The theme that runs through our conversation today is that of transformation, how this experience has transformed his life, his medical practice, and how we can all use this experience to transform ourselves and society for the better.
I'm Montana Skirka, and this is Life Support.
Hi, Ariel.
Hi. Hello.
So,
have we actually started?
Yeah, now we're starting. If we start before we say we start, then I'll feel less nervous.
Okay.
So you were the first person I interviewed for a Life Support podcast.
What an honor.
A long time ago, a year and a half ago. Feels like
wow.
Lots happened since then. Always. And now I get to see you again, a little bit farther apart, but it's so nice to see you.
It's such a pleasure to be here again.
Yeah. So
I'm in my own house. And it's only a marginal pleasure to be here, but it's a pleasure to be on the show.
And I'm putting you back on Life Support, which feels like it sort of has this more morbid feel to it now.
Mm.
But
yeah, you know, it always was a bit of a dark joke. And I think that, you know, if humor doesn't get us through, then nothing will.
Mm. Yeah, the last person I interviewed for this, actually, which I have not put out yet, he was talking about laughter and the importance of improv in medicine. And he was like, laughter is the second best form of medicine. He's like, what's the first form? I didn't know the answer. Apparently it's medicine, which makes sense.
Yes, but that was a huge part of medical school, was medicine.
But laughter's number two, so gotta bring
laughter
it in.
Laughter was just only a year, whereas medicine was like 2.5 years of the 4 years. There you have it. Oh, can you imagine? I would have had such a better time.
Oh my gosh. That would have been interesting.
Mm.
So right now you've quit a different job than you did last time I interviewed you, or a different role.
Well, it's a different world. I am usually a regular old medicine doctor, but more recently I've been a COVID doctor, which is really just a medicine doctor for COVID patients, but I had the dubious honor of caring for the patients on the COVID ward, the patients outside of the ICU who required hospitalization at Sunnybrook Hospital. I've spent 3 weeks of my past little while doing that. It's been quite a journey.
For sure. Of course the world has changed so much for all of us, which I think is such a unique feature of this time, that this is one little virus that has impacted every single person on the planet. I think we could say that pretty safely.
Mm-hmm.
And you having a really pretty unique vantage point. What has your experience been like, and how has your role shifted in this time?
So, you know, I'm perfectly happy to go to work and come home and really not tell anybody about anything about my day. Like, I'm happy to work in the background, and suddenly I'm thrust into this situation where I'm going to work to see the patients that everyone in the entire world is talking about and is afraid of. And it feels it feels like being at the center of the maelstrom. Like, it's all a little bit too, it's like, yeah, medicine for COVID, this is me. This is, I am doing what everyone is, every single news article is about one thing right now. So it's all a little, what was the question? It's
no, that's really interesting that you're talking, as soon as you said, you know, you're saying that everyone's afraid of these patients. Everyone's afraid of COVID. And also, mm-hmm. I wanted to talk to you about this war terminology, because it makes me personally feel pretty uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we're talking about a war on COVID,
mm-hmm.
using all this, the enemy, warlike
imagery, and I'm not sure. I mean, our war on drugs hasn't been very successful, but it seems like when we turn something into a war, it doesn't end well for us. But in this sort of war, there's this major fear against COVID, but proxy to that is a fear of the COVID patients, which is really interesting to me, because it's also, there's so much talk about protecting our society and protecting people. There's so much concern for these patients, yet so much fear for them, which is really interesting.
I mean, that is all fascinating. Like we could write 7 essays about that.
I know. It's
just so 100%. There's a whole lot of war terminology, and a lot that that I've been unable to avoid. You know, frontline workers and being redeployed. And you know,
did you sign up for the military? Did you know when you entered medical school that you were going to be a frontline worker? Like, what?
And you know, I think that for a long time, people have known that a pandemic would result in doctors being the frontline folks.
Right.
So yeah, I guess I did sign up for it, but it just never felt like it felt now. Like before my first couple of weeks on the COVID ward, I had people reaching out being like, thank you for your service. You know, good luck and God bless. And I'm just going to work, guys. Like, you know, going to the office, right? So I think that a lot of that terminology came from how people saw me and how people saw my role and the roles of my colleagues. And I think that it is problematic in a lot of ways that you mentioned, and also in the way that it causes, it makes people into the enemy instead of the virus. You know, of course we care about the patients who have COVID, but we also, we fear them. We don't just fear their virus. And I think that after spending time with these patients, with patients with COVID, I really feel profoundly transformed in regard to how I think about isolation and disease and being sick in hospital, because I would go in and these are the most isolated patients on earth, right? They can't see anybody except if they're full glove, gown, mask, like Darth Vader through the mask. It's like a movie asylum, right? You know, it's really, really isolating. And so the doctor who handed over to me, who had been on for the preceding days, said, listen, we don't have any treatments for these patients. We don't have anything that we can do for them except for a bit of oxygen. And so what you can do is be a human, is be compassionate, is take away some of their suffering from their isolation, is answer their questions in a way that's compassionate, that understands their perspective and their position. That's the best we can do.
Right.
And I really took that to heart, and I really found that to be the case. I'll tell you one story. One of the first patients that I saw was a young man in his 30s, like me, like you, and he was all alone. English was not his first language. He wasn't sure if he was missing something about the diagnosis. He really didn't have anybody to talk to about what his fears were and really get to the bottom of what he could do to potentially save his life and the life of his family members. And he was really, really afraid, just so, so afraid. And, I walked in and I started chatting with him and I could see how scared he was. And I realized that his first language was a language that I speak. And so I switched into his native language and I've never seen anybody look so relieved. Like all the tension came out of him and suddenly I was able to kind of put him at ease in a way that I think I never could have done in English. And he was thankful and felt less alone. And I said, well, that's the best thing I've done all day. Like I haven't changed literally anything about the care that I provided for him. And yet something was changed for him. And I think taking that lesson forward for my entire practice, God willing, it will not be COVID forever. I think that's transformative.
Absolutely. I mean, we were kind of joking about laughter being medicine, but ultimately, like that exchange, it's medicine. And I think these types of, it seems to me that issues in society, issues that we've talked about on this podcast, it's just highlighting how important they are, how important the role of compassion is between individuals within these systems.
It goes back to the war analogy. And one of the main drawbacks of the war analogy is how success and failure are defined.
Right.
When you talk about a war on cancer, you say, so-and-so was fighting their cancer and unfortunately it metastasized and then they lost their long battle with cancer.
Yes.
And so then that for that patient, the war was lost and it was a failure and everyone should be upset about it. And obviously it's sad when somebody dies, but when you have no treatments or when you have people who are old or when you have people who for whom success could be defined differently when we don't have any way to change the trajectory of the illness, we have to think about success and failure differently. So suppose yes. that 30-year-old something man, he survived, thank God, and he probably would have survived regardless of what I did, although it was nice to give him some oxygen and to monitor him and to make sure everything was done as safely as possible. But he probably would have survived despite my care or in spite of my care or besides right. the fact. But if we define success and failure as only regarding survival or death, then we miss an enormous pocket of things that we can do that can be defined as a success because I relieved some suffering through connection. And I think that palliative care doctors know this the most, right? Mm. All of their patients die. And they're not going to practice for more than a week if all of their patients dying means that all of their patient interactions are failures. They aren't, right? A good death, peace at the end of life, relieving suffering, bringing connection, taking away symptoms of that are horrible. Those are successes, and they have to be defined as such. And our terminology should recognize that.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought this up because this is my favorite topic. And something that it really like redefining success and failure, because it also has to do with our understanding of progress. And everyone, I mean, before this hit, whenever I would read about people that had this sort of obsession with elongating life and, you know, these dreams that people have of sort of eradicating a war on death mm-hmm. and just expanding life expectancy, it's like, is that our only goal? And maybe it is for some people, but for other people, it's about what our quality of life is. And for that cancer patient, first of all, saying that they succumb to cancer is a failure on their part is extremely problematic. But also, if the mental health implications, like for example, the you know extreme trauma that many people face when they're in these circumstances, if that is not addressed, but it's like, oh, we saved this person's life, check mark, now off they go. That's incomplete in certain ways. And also it's confusing for the person, for example, in my circumstance when I was very young and undergoing this, and then I was, you won. Like you won because you're alive. And so any anxiety or depression or confusion or fear or health anxiety that I experienced, which it feels like everyone is kind of experiencing a little bit right now, it's pushed under the rug. Like I felt guilty for it.
I think what you say about goals of care really carries a lot of weight right now in terms of people discussing what constitutes a success or a failure in their own care. Because obviously in the hospital, we've been really afraid and have had a lot of anticipatory anxiety around the great wave that may overwhelm our capacity to care for people. And thankfully, we haven't seen that in Toronto as we've seen in other parts of the world. But where we have seen really tragic COVID cases and the overwhelming of resources has been in the long-term care settings. Where you have really elderly and vulnerable people who are getting COVID en masse and having terrible outcomes. And it's to the credit of the patients and the people caring for them and the families of the patients who are having tough goals of care conversations, that is conversations about what they would and wouldn't want out of their care, knowing how poor the outcomes are likely if they were to, say, require a respirator or care in the ICU, and knowing how much suffering comes with that at a limited benefit to them overall, means that they can make really tough decisions and say, listen, if I come out of this, if I can recover with a bit of oxygen and a bit of fluids and a bit of tender, loving care from that perspective, great. But if it looks like I'm not going to make it, then a palliative care, comfort-based approach might be more humane than trying to do everything that we can to keep someone alive. And I think that really speaks to your your perspective on the individual and societal level about how we define success in treatments.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's not different. You know, I'm sure there are lots of different illnesses or things that can happen to people where those conversations would be helpful. And I wonder if this sort of brings up for people this understanding that maybe we should be having these conversations in general.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, there's an obvious and understandable fear of death that we all feel. I think that it's a pretty ancient feeling, biologically driven. But I also think, I feel like that's sort of growing. I think it's part of this drive that people are genuinely, like scientists truly researching how to eradicate death and mm-hmm. elongate life no matter what, sort of. And I think that underneath that, there's like this lack of just accepting our humanity, accepting our fragility as humans, our vulnerability. And I feel like that's a huge part of this health anxiety, is that a lot of people were not prepared for something like this to happen, nor should they be. But it almost feels mm-hmm. like people with chronic illness or with histories of acute or chronic health conditions have come to terms with these types of questions, or have at least faced them before.
Mm-hmm.
I feel, from my own perspective, it's been really interesting. There's a part of me that feels like almost familiar with a lot of the feelings that have come up, that I think has fortified me in a way. I mean, also, I'm in a really privileged position and I'm not suffering with any symptoms of the illness right now. But I also feel, and I've talked to other people with histories of chronic and acute illness, and it's like we have a part of our brain that's like, oh, this is the time when we have to go retreat to this part, you know, this aspect of our life. And it's really interesting to watch other people who haven't had those histories have to be like, wait, like, who am I without these questions that we have to face when we're dealt with an illness? Who am I without my career? Like, what do I care about in terms of quality of life? You know, what do I value? What are the things that matter to me? Mm. And it's been sort of interesting to watch
things that only can come to the forefront in cases where you grapple with your own health and with your own vulnerability. So I'm really fascinating. I'm curious to hear what you'll have to say to the next thing I'm going to say, which is that I share your enthusiasm for people talking about goals of care in peacetime, so to speak, to use another war metaphor.
Right.
But you know, knowing and having had these conversations quite a bit, I know that people have a lot of trouble with them, not just because they're shy about death, but also because they don't have the clinical and medical background to talk about it meaningfully.
Right.
You know, even my own parents, who are both doctors themselves, different types of doctors than me, haven't had this conversation perhaps as much as I have, and at least recently. And so, you know, haven't been able to conceptually translate that to themselves. And I have a better idea with the medical knowledge, especially of COVID, to think through those things, I think. And so it's not enough to say like, hey, how do you feel about machines that breathe for you? Are you for them or against them, right? Like it's just so much more complex than that.
Right.
But the other thing that I wanted to say is how I completely agree that even those people who are currently healthy, by virtue of the fact that this pandemic is, you know, across the entire world, because it's a pandemic, it means that everybody is grappling with their mortality, regardless of whether they've actually had it or not. So that, of course, right, includes me, just being a doctor on the COVID unit, but it also is my next door neighbor, and their next door neighbor, and everyone who has read any news articles, right? And so suddenly you have people grappling with these questions that they hadn't had to before, healthy people, right? And I think a lot of people are thrust into the situation that you have had a lot of experience being in, which is like, what if my body doesn't work? Or what if I'm, you know, facing my own mortality down? And that's scary, but it also has some fringe benefits, right? Like, I've spoken now to people who have survived COVID and have kind of reflected on what that means. I've spoken to colleagues who survived SARS and what that meant 17 years ago and how that's impacted the past 17 years of their life.
Wow.
And it can be transformative. My colleague told me, you know, even now, 17 years later, he is thankful for every day that he gets to wake up. He doesn't take anything for granted. And I said to him, you know, if only I can learn those lessons without having to almost die.
Yes.
You know,
and
he kind of smiled. But I say that because it sounds really good. But to be perfectly honest, I don't know how to do that. I'm here at home, stuck here like everyone else, waiting for my next week on service to start next Tuesday, and thinking about the fact that it's really hard to care for a toddler, for a two-year-old constantly, and how, boy, wouldn't it be nice to go to the mall, and not at all being as thankful for every day that I get to wake up as I should be, regardless of the fact that I've had these really impactful conversations. So I think that translating that into this like blissful existence of appreciating every day because you know it could be your last, easier said than done.
Oh man, there's so many things I want to say about that. the first part of what you're talking about in terms of these difficult conversations and how much sort of knowledge you need in order to make effective and intelligent decisions for yourself about what makes sense in terms of your care. Mm. That makes me think a lot about it. That's true not only for life and death situations of would you like to be on a ventilator or not. It's also true for it's true for lots of different treatments, I think. Mm-hmm. I believe that every drug, every type of medicine that we are given or that we have has some sort of side effect. Please tell me if I'm wrong.
You're right.
So yeah. So I mean, and I think that when we're not, again, if we're not talking about goals with people in terms of anything that they're diagnosed with, I think that there might be a misunderstanding if the doctor assumes, or whoever's making the decisions assumes, that they know what the patient wants out of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a conversation that we can start hopefully having across the board. And I know it's a difficult conversation and it's complex. And again, like when a patient is facing these decisions, they're in potentially a lot of pain. There's a lot of fear around it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if, so I guess that's why this, peacetime conversation is helpful, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, I just think that when I think about my own care, again, in terms of like, if you're diagnosed with something and then you're given these treatment options and you don't have a lot of time to talk with a doctor and you know that they're the one who really understands, okay, what does it mean if this medication increases my risk of this type of deadly lymphoma this much? And how do I make, you know, for me, like those types of complicated, very scary decisions,
mm-hmm.
Maybe I don't feel like I have enough time, or I'm not really, I don't know. It's just difficult.
No, I really agree with you. So a study that I worked on with some colleagues a couple of years back, we used a framework for understanding goals of care that separated the goals out into seven different basic goals. And they were to cure disease, to live longer, to improve function, maintain function. I am doing off the top of my head here, be comfortable, achieve a certain goal or life goal, bring comfort to family members and caregivers. Those were the seven. Mm. And that is not just true in general, but it's actually task specific or treatment specific. So for example, if you have your garden variety cold, then your goal will likely be to be comfortable, to bring comfort, which is not something that you would consider as a healthy person, but that is what you want. You want a medication that's going to make you feel more comfortable because we don't have a cure for the common cold. But if you come in with pneumonia, probably you're looking for cure first and symptoms later, although you might be looking for a combination of those. And so understanding all management like that, including chronic disease, changes how we think about, you know, an arthritis doctor might assume that a patient wants to, you know, have symptom relief or improve their function or a combination of that. But if you don't talk to the patient and find out what they're actually interested in, what is affecting their life and how their disease is changing their outlook and the, how they live their life, you're going to miss something and you're going to potentially cook up a huge treatment plan that isn't really proper or appropriate for that patient. So I share your perspective.
Yeah. And also for how long, right? Like I know steroids are used for many chronic illnesses and ultimately they're a band-aid. We can't use them forever. So there's that element thrown into the mix as well.
Especially when we have lots of patients to see, we consider one size fits all, and that size that's going to be fit is going to be our perspective as the doctors, where you say, oh, well, surely you're going to want to have X, Y, and Z because it's going to have A, B, and C results, which are good things. And we haven't actually chatted with the patient to make sure that's the case.
I mean, I've been thinking more and more that I feel like there needs to be like a philosopher that sort of accompanies the doctor in these appointments.
Well, now I think you're just flattering me for the sake of it, because you know I have a philosophy background.
Oh, I actually forgot about that, to be honest. But no, I've been thinking about this more and more, because ultimately these conversations that happen in a healthcare setting, they're existential questions about suffering and life and death, and you can't expect a doctor to be able to cover this, because I mean they're also dealing with their own feelings towards these issues. So I just think, you know, maybe we're entering an age where, you know, now that doctors are not necessarily, it's not just acute, there's much more people with chronic illness and long-term care than ever before. There needs to be these expanding conversations about redefining, you know, helping people. There's these, and it kind of goes into the second part of what you said about how the difficult moments in our life can be true moments of transformation. This idea of post-traumatic growth that is very different than the way that a lot of us grew up, where I think it was sort of this understanding that the more you're protected from harm, the better off you are. Mm-hmm. And it's very understandable for parents to want to protect their children from harm.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this whole sort of epidemic of helicopter parenting of very, very well-meaning people who would like to protect their children. But I think it really robs individuals of this feeling of being able to overcome obstacles. And it also places a huge amount of fear in people when we face inevitable obstacles. We're all going to be patients in our life. We're all going to face illness in some way. And so can we give ourselves and give society the tools in order to feel empowered to face these things as best we can and as gracefully as we can, not as a war, but as a, you know, as an obstacle that we're going to try our best to live well through.
Right. So I think that there's an enormously important point that I wanted to make based off of something you said, which is that and I think that you've spoken to this before, is the fact that when you get, say, discharged after a life-changing illness, and the perspective of the healthcare team and therefore of your family and yourself is off you go to live your life again like you did before, like you're better now, and now you're cured, and off you go to imagine that it's a couple months ago or it's a couple years ago and you're better now. Right. And and forget about the fact that you've been through something, or kind of bury that fact. You're better now, right? And people just don't, they simply don't feel that way. Like they feel like they've been transformed even when they are better physically.
Right.
But despite a few scars. And so something that, that you and I may have spoken about before is this beautiful concept, the Japanese term kintsukuroi, and I'm going to probably misspeak here, but to paraphrase, it's pottery that has been broken and then put together, sealed with gold, put together where the lines that fix the cracks are sealed with gold. And the idea is that something can be more beautiful or differently beautiful for having been broken, that it's not necessarily always better to never break, but that you can actually come out the other side being different and whole in a different way than you were before. And I think that this is hugely important for individuals to understand that, everyone's experienced this. Like when I think about those times in my life that were formative, it was times that were hard, right? Like right. I feel like I developed my self-confidence by being bullied in middle school. Mm. Medical school. I wasn't bullied as much.
I hope not.
But being bullied in middle school was, you know, like, and I think that that's not uncommon, that formative times can be hard times, and that you redefine your identity having had a hard time. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's going to be really important for society to put itself back together after all of this COVID nonsense, is not to say like, let's go back to regular life. When can we get back to regular life? When can we open the doors and just pretend like this never happened?
Right.
Like it happened. It's a really big deal. It's affected everyone on earth, like you said, you know? And so thinking about ways that we can redefine ourselves as individuals and as a society are really important. And I think there's enormous lessons to be taken away from COVID, which I can speak to as well.
No, I think that's so true. I mean, the mental health, it truly was an epidemic before this crisis hit. And I think there's still so much stigma and misinformation and confusion around mental health and addiction, and a feeling of wanting to sort of stuff it under the rug. And I think it seems to me that this current health crisis is sort of putting it all to the forefront. And I really hope that, I think the only way to really transform an experience from something that's very difficult or into something transformative is to have a place that you can process that, that you can understand how that has changed you and what you've learned from it. And I really hope that we are given an opportunity as a society to have these places, to have these conversations, and that the stigma, is lessened, because I think that's the way that we can start to understand what we just all went through collectively and individually, and how we've transformed from this. And I mean, especially, particularly with medical professionals, because I was reading some statistics about how doctors have the highest suicide rate in America, and depression is extremely high, burnout, of course, extremely high, particularly among women physicians, actually. Mm-hmm. And of course, the stigma is so high in society in general, but specifically within the physician community. And I hope that we're able to, it's like we can see each other as human a little bit more now, and see each other as we're all patients, we're all healers in different ways, and how can we help each other through?
Mm-hmm. Well, something that you mentioned was that mental health problems did not start with COVID, right?
No.
They've been going on the whole time. They've been an epidemic the whole time.
Yeah.
And something that COVID has done the most effectively is laid bare those aspects in our society where inequity and trouble lies. Like suddenly we're all noticing things that have existed the entire time, right? Like, wait a second, we never respected the cleaning staff at the hospital. And now suddenly for the first time, we're realizing they're frontline workers. They're putting themselves in harm's way. They're doing enormously important work and they aren't getting compensated accordingly. Same with the grocery clerks and the delivery folks and all these people who are paid not very much and are doing heroic and risky things for society, right? That's not just today, right? Like, that's not new. Neither is mental health. Neither is the fact that living month to month only surviving because you work three jobs as an unsustainable model. That's not new right now. But now that everyone is off work at the same time, suddenly we're realizing that fact. Suddenly we're realizing that having no social supports is not going to be good, or that universal healthcare is not a luxury but an absolute moral necessity for the individual and for society at large, because our health depends on the health of our neighbors. Right? These aren't new concepts. They're just suddenly being realized. And what I really hope is that we don't forget them when COVID goes away, God willing.
Right. Well, I mean, in talking about kintsugi, I mean, if we pretend that the cracks are not there in the pottery, we cannot fill them with gold. So absolutely. It's like, absolutely. Right? So it's like this pandemic has exposed the cracks and sort of deepened the cracks that are already there.
Yes.
We've been barely holding this thing together.
Yes. It's validating feelings and emotions. It's the microest, right? It's how to care for a toddler is how to care for society, right? If I tell my son, like, you know, he's upset because I closed the door and he wanted to close the door, I'll be like, dude, bro, like, it's no problem. We'll close many doors in our life, right? That's not going to comfort him. Only if I validate what he's feeling, only if I validate there is something that has upset you and we can work together to come to terms with it, right? Like, pretending that problems don't exist is an amazing way of perpetuating problems.
Yes, telling people, you know, making people who are suffering from mental health issues or burnout, because of our individualistic nature of society and the way that we view each individual as their own entity, it's like, oh, if you have a mental health problem, that's you. Like, that has nothing to do with society. That has nothing to do with what's going on around you. That's your concern. If you're in poverty, that's your concern. It's like exposing, you know, the lunacy of that. And then the goal that we're painting, I mean, I'm so glad that you're talking about these the janitors in the hospitals and these unsung heroes, and they're the ones that hopefully we can begin to celebrate. And the little acts of kindness, like those, that's the goal that's beginning to emerge. All the stories that we're hearing about, you know, people, you had a beautiful story about that's something that happened on your street. Birthday party.
No, I have thought a lot about the fact that crises bring out the worst and the best in people. And something that I found incredibly moving was that, you know, we have a Facebook group of our little neighborhood, and people are really, you know, they've always been sharing and caring. But, you know, at this time of crisis, when everyone is in need, it's been wonderful to see how people help each other. But something I couldn't help myself but be moved by was, there was a little girl who was turning 6 years old and who was really bummed out to not be able to have a birthday party and not be able to see friends. And so her parents posted, it's so-and-so's birthday and it's coming up on Thursday. And so if people wanted to put signs up in their windows, we're going to go on a birthday walk at this and that time, and we're going to go around and see them. And then a few days later, they went around and they posted these pictures of their daughter in front of all these different signs, happy birthday, happy birthday. And she went around and all of these strangers had put up signs wishing this little girl a happy birthday. And I was like, you know, nothing could be cheesier in the world, but I was just totally, totally overcome by this. And I thought it was just like, it's very life affirming to be able to share humanity and share, to do that, you have to not just revel in happiness, but acknowledge the shared despair that we have. So again, to validate those feelings of loneliness in order to turn them into something wonderful.
I love that. That's really beautiful. I think that's a great way to end our talk today. As usual, I could talk to you forever.
Yes. Now that we're doing it remotely, I have no excuse.
I know, right?
Happy to come back.
Well, I mean, I guess I don't want to thank you for your service. But, you know, thank you for all the work that you're doing. It's very much appreciated. And I look forward to continuing to have these conversations with you and seeing, you know, what we can do now and for each other and in the future to build the society that we're talking about.
Me too. And thanks for what you're doing too. I think this is incredibly important work also.
Thanks, Ariel. See you soon. Take care.
Take care.